plaza is also a prime example of architecture that shows the elegance of a civilization, which is still an immeasurable part of the Al-Andalus identity. This majestic example of architecture, even after being recaptured by the Christians, retained its elegance and was developed by Muslim architects once again. Outside these walls, Giralda can be seen. The mosque's minaret is adjacent to the Al-Khazar Castle. This minaret, which is currently being used as the Catholic Church steeple, became the international symbol of Seville City. This is one of the famous historical landmarks in the capital city, Al-Andalus.
Historically, people, academia and politicians have always noticed the importance of the Islamic Seville in its own era. Seville played an important role, both in the time of war and peace. Even today, the name of Seville can be found in political books. There are also other proven facts, such as immigrants that can be seen in the streets or working in institutions in the city of Seville.
Every day, thousands of tourists, mostly Muslims from every corner of the globe, visit their historical heritage. They can't help thinking about the past, the time when things were better for Muslims. This statement holds true for this neighborhood and the ones on the outskirts of Seville, where many Muslim immigrants, mostly Moroccan, reside. This neighborhood has been devastated by economic strife, unemployment, and a lack of social resources. The basement of this building, which isn't easily noticed, is one of the six mosques in the town. Perhaps it is better to describe it as something more like a hall for the Muslim community to perform their religious rituals in. This place is located among the malls and business centers that used to thrive in the past.
Assalamu alaikum, yo soy Jihad.
Hi, I'm Jihad Sarasua from Seville, Al-Andalus. I'm a Muslim. We are in Ishbilia Mosque that we built in the Maid's neighborhood, so Muslims could perform their rituals. This is one of the popular neighborhoods of Seville, where many of us are living together. This mosque was built to meet today's needs of the Muslim community. This is all we have in this neighborhood. This neighborhood belongs to the working class, so this place is okay considering the fact that there is no business or social centers here. We have to, as Muslims, build up a community in such a poor condition. But we need a place where Muslims of Seville can get together to display the true image of Muslim communities, right? Yes, of course, we need that. We are working hard to get what we want. We need a proper neighborhood to show the splendid image of Islam in Seville.
Probably asking the municipality on behalf of the Muslim community of the city would make them grant us a loan. We could use it for Bujaira Mosque, located in Mila de Oura, Seville. We also have historical background in our favor. The constructions will be close to the Al-Khazar Castle, one of the greatest preserved treasures from the caliphates. There we meet Javier Fito, one of the residents of Seville, who is defending his Muslim community's right to a place where they can perform their rituals and congregations.
As far as I know, most of the mosques are in the basements of buildings. Sometimes these places get really crowded and there is also a lack of space and standard conditions. In the best case scenario, we can only have access to emergency exits. We don't even have the basic conditions here. Trying to have the right place is what we can do to make this situation better. Mosques are supposed to be social centers and community spaces, just like Catholic churches or any other social centers. We should have a better place for public use. What we have right now is still far away from what we have in mind. These places are really cramped. These buildings are not designed for religious purposes. Therefore, problems like poor standards of hygiene arise.
This is what the Muslim community has been struggling against for 25 years. These struggles started when some people in Seville who had converted to Islam openly asked for a proper mosque. While other religious communities had a better situation, they continued to struggle because they had to gather in unsuitable places to pray together.
There are some lecture halls for praying in the basements, lower floors or on the outskirts of Seville. There is no congregational mosque in Dol in spite of efforts to have one.
The idea of building this mosque became a contentious issue in the 90s. At that time, I was a member of the city council and I held the position until 2003. It all started when the Muslim community went to the municipality to get them convinced to have a congregational mosque. Well, personally, I believe that almost everyone in the municipality and political parties there liked the idea, because the idea had a sense of mutual respect and religious freedom. It's quite natural, isn't it? So, different religions can have their own place to perform their rituals. There could also be some other aspects in addition to having a mosque. At the beginning, it seemed that there was no problem with it. There were talks about renting a place for that purpose in Seville, somewhere that had traces of Islamic traditions. Everything passed so quickly and there was no result. They noticed it would be problematic to convert an old church into a mosque in the center of the city. They wanted more than that. It was more affordable to have it built in a new neighborhood. That was when they looked at Bermejal as an option, right?
This is the mosque in Seville. The only accepted and known mosque in the city that we can talk about as a mosque without any inhibitions is this one. Especially when the famous footballer Frederick Knut bought this place and gave it to Al-Ikhwan Al-Muslimun, who, after some failed attempts to build a mosque, took the initiative and managed this place.
We gathered at Al-Andalus Parliament to talk it out with MPs and PSOE. Then we asked for the place, just like what other religious communities had, a place with good conditions and enough space for public use. Then we officially registered our request, and after 2 months we got our answer. We had an agreement to allot a place to the Muslim community. It was out of the city with no other buildings around, and we had no other way but to accept it. After a while, we noticed it wouldn't be that bad in the distant future. We accepted it, and we did the paperwork, and we even got the deeds and documents.
Now they have started working on the construction of this mosque on the land which belonged to the Muslim community. The responsibility was given to this young architect from Seville, and they started the project with a predetermined fund of more than 3 million euros. This mosque was supposed to be one of the biggest mosques in Europe, a building of 3,000 square meters, two floors, a capacity of more than 2,000 people, a public yard and a private parking lot. A mosque which would finally give the Muslims of this city a place to congregate. And of course, the rest of the people of Seville would be able to enjoy the modern atmosphere of the place in which followers of different religions and schools of thought could gather to swap ideas and information.
El volumen principal, como no puede ser otra forma, es la nave que hace de oratorio.
The original structure was a ship of two floors with a dome covered by green tiles. Undoubtedly, genders are separated in accordance with the Islamic law. So the first floor would be used by men and the second floor by women. In the center, we have two hollow places leading to the dome. And in the front, we have the Qibla with a somewhat upward slope to show a symbolic feature which can only be seen in a mosque. Around the main yard, we would have different services. Some of them were considered for public use and some of them more private, such as a halal restaurant, a cafeteria, a library, and a place for other cultural activities, originally designed to be used as a cultural environment for public use.
Now that we had the land, the project was presented, accepted, and funded to start. Everything was ready to end 10 years of marginalization. It was almost impossible for the growing number of Muslims in Seville to dream of a mosque, but then everything went wrong.
Soon, a rumor went around that a mosque was going to be built, something that wasn't easy to hide. It didn't seem bad or something that neighbors wouldn't like. The idea of building a mosque wasn't against the society or any other religious sects. Well, it's hard to find an old church in the city center district. It's obvious that we can't find a space in the city center. That's why the idea of building new neighborhoods came up. Normally, in an old neighborhood, the government had already monopolized the lands and any other construction activities. Everything was running smoothly until the neighbors found out about the mosque and they reacted badly against it.
The neighborhood was biased against building a mosque. Biased, yes. Most of these immigrants from the West are economically down. And in most cases, they cannot even meet their basic needs. It's not right to think of keeping the poor and the immigrants away from yourself. We shouldn't forget, not too long ago, we had the same situation when we had to emigrate to France or Germany. I think all we needed was a smile and more support instead of xenophobia.
This is Conchita Rivas. She has been the chief of the Bermejales neighborhood since it was established. She is one of the public figures against the construction of the mosque. They claim they have no intention of insulting the Muslim community. They simply prefer a medical clinic to a mosque. Today, they are passing by an abandoned land with no mosque or any other construction in the public interest.
At the beginning, it was mentioned in the press that Muslims want to build the biggest mosque in Europe. We went to the municipality for some explanations, and they said that it had already been planned and there was nothing we could do about it. I told them that Bermejales community had also a part in making decisions. We'd had other important plans on the agenda and they hadn't been actualized yet. This is why we disagreed. However, we held a referendum in Paseo de Europa Park to decide the issue. In addition, on our left side, we had a related opinion box for saying yes or no to the mosque. There wasn't even one ballot paper in the ballot box.
A partir de ese momento en el que se hace esa asamblea informativa,
then we received information indicating that anything bad could happen. We tried the idea two times and they opposed us each time. We tried to sort things out. We talked to them and we talked to the press to tell them they had no right to treat us like animals. Behind all this, there were also children at the school to whom the idea of xenophobia was indoctrinated by the neighbors. This issue was spreading nationwide. On the internet, we could see anti-mosque posts on websites from across Spain, Valencia, Madrid. We received emails and messages that had no indication of the term coexistence.
Documents and newspaper pieces are about the Mosque Project lawsuit, the project begun by the Muslim community. It was interesting to see the unusual presence of the National Intelligence Center at different stages of the whole issue, and both sides of the struggle mention this.
I met with two officials in the National Intelligence Center. These people were trying to convince me that I had to forget about the whole thing. But I had my goals. I have always fought against injustice, ignorance, and whatever I'd find insulting. I told them that I wasn't going to give up.
Nuestras relaciones con los organismos de información del Estado son directas.
We were in direct contact with the CNI itself and the CNI police.
Desde el CNI hasta
in every aspect, we were frank and direct. We had nothing to hide from the society.
Es decir, nosotros no hemos ocultado ni tenemos nada que ocultar a la sociedad.
After a long lawsuit, the Supreme Court voted in favor of the neighbors, and the municipality was criticized for poor decision making. Now, the municipality was trying to find a new place for the mosque. The new place was on Cartuja Island, where international exhibitions used to be held in 1992, a combination of abandoned, transferred, and constructed lands for educational and business purposes. The entrepreneurial community of Seville was the last to oppose the construction of the mosque. We chose three places: a church, a piece of land for public use in a newly built neighborhood, and a piece of land in an area for public services. Three projects, three hopes, three failures. But the Muslims did not give up. They chose another piece of land to buy in a neighborhood of San Jeromino. Once again, the neighbors took to the streets and the same scenes took place. Even some extremists buried a pig in the land chosen for the construction to make fun of Islamic law, which asserts pigs are unclean. The truth is that they wanted to stop them from building the mosque, no matter what. Finally, the whole project came to a halt.
I believe that this issue, apart from being politically motivated, was a problem of coexistence. And also another crucial factor can be the lack of understanding a civilization or a certain way of thinking. I think all these contributing factors sapped the mosque project. Personally, I truly believe that Muslims in Seville deserve a proper mosque.
It's hard to believe that a city like Seville, which was ruled by Muslims for more than five or six centuries with its Islamic background, has no place for Muslims to perform their rituals. Most of the neighborhoods oppose the idea of constructing a mosque, although more important issues can be found in these neighborhoods. We are in San Jeronimo, La Macarena. Since the time of economic crisis, this part of the city has been hit by depression. These people are losing everything. Yet, they demonstrate not against these crises, not against unemployment or their violated rights, but against their neighbors who want to build a place to do their rituals, simply because they don't understand the metaphysical values behind it. These people have no reason to stop the Muslims to build a mosque.
Whoever wants to be the Seville mayor has to know that the city needs a place to represent the Muslim community. Honestly, according to our constitution, our city deserves such a place. We will try to find another way, with the help of the private sector, to get this project done. And we hope to make it happen in the years to come. An unofficial census estimates the population of the Muslim community to be around 10,000, representing at least 20 different nations. Most of them were converted Spaniards, Moroccans, and others from southern parts of Africa.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Please stay tuned.
این آیه رو تابلو کنیم بزنیم توی منازل و خانه هامون دل و چشمون ببینیم.
الله in the Holy Quran Surah An-Najm Ayahs 36 to 41 states, has he not been informed of what is in the scriptures of Moses and of Abraham who fulfilled his summons, that no bearer shall bear another's burden, and that nothing belongs to man except what he strives for, and that he will soon be shown his endeavor. Then he will be rewarded for it with the fullest reward. We must have this ayah always in our mind because it is very rich in content. In this ayah, we are informed of three pieces of news which are all approved by prophets of Allah, namely Moses, Abraham, and Muhammad. Now, what are these three concepts which are emphasized by Allah?
انسان در گرو تلاش خودش، یک، دو.
One of them is that everyone is responsible for his or her own deeds, and no one can shoulder the burden of another person. This means that in the other world, you are accountable for what you did in this world. The second point is that one must attempt in his life in order to reach his belongings, which mean that you should work hard to fulfill your desires. And the third one is that in the other world, everyone is shown the result of his action in this world. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
New findings by researchers re-emphasize the importance of short-range COVID transmission, with physical distancing and mask wearing likely to be the most effective means of preventing infection. Ventilation, though still worthwhile, is likely to have a lesser impact. We'll prepare for you an article written by Linda Geddes. The piece is titled, Study Says COVID Loses 90% of Ability to Infect Within Minutes in Air. The world's first simulations of how the coronavirus survives in exhaled air suggest coronavirus loses 90% of its ability to infect us within 20 minutes of becoming airborne, with most of the loss occurring within the first 5 minutes. The findings re-emphasize the importance of short-range COVID transmission, with physical distancing and mask wearing likely to be the most effective means of preventing infection. Ventilation, though still worthwhile, is likely to have a lesser impact. Professor Jonathan Reed, director of the University of Bristol's Aerosol Research Centre and the study's lead author, said, "People have been focused on poorly ventilated spaces and thinking about airborne transmission over meters or across a room. I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but I think still the greatest risk of exposure is when you're close to someone," adding, "When you move further away, not only is the aerosol diluted down, there's also less infectious virus because the virus has lost infectivity as a result of time. Until now, our assumptions about how long the virus survives in tiny airborne droplets have been based on studies that involve spraying virus into sealed vessels called Goldberg drums, which rotate to keep the droplets airborne. Using this method, U.S. researchers found the infectious virus could still be detected after 3 hours. Yet such experiments do not accurately replicate what happens when we cough or when we breathe. Instead, researchers from the University of Bristol developed apparatus that allowed them to generate any number of tiny virus-containing particles and gently levitate them between two electric rings for anywhere between 5 seconds to 20 minutes, while tightly controlling the temperature, humidity, and UV light intensity of their surroundings. Professor Jonathan Reed said, "This is the first time anyone has been able to actually simulate what happens to the aerosol during the exhalation process." The study, which has not yet been peer-reviewed, suggested that as the viral particles leave the relatively moist and carbon dioxide-rich conditions of the lungs, they rapidly lose water and dry out, while the transition to lower levels of carbon dioxide is associated with a rapid increase in pH. Both of these factors disrupt the virus's ability to infect human cells, but the speed at which the particles dry out varies according to the relative humidity of the surrounding air. When this was lower than 50%, similar to relatively dry air found in many offices, the virus has lost around half of its infectivity within 5 seconds, after which the decline was slower and more steady, with a further 19% loss over the next 5 minutes. At 90% humidity, roughly equivalent to a steam or shower room, the decline in infectivity was more gradual, with 52% of particles remaining infectious after 5 minutes, dropping to about 10% after 20 minutes, after which there was no difference between the two conditions. However, the temperature of the air made no difference to viral infectivity, contradicting the widely held belief that the viral transmission is lower at high temperatures. Professor Jonathan Reed said, "It means that if I'm meeting friends for lunch, the primary risk is likely to be transmitting it to my friends or my friends transmitting it to me, rather than it being transmitted from someone on the other side of the room." Adding, "This highlights the importance of wearing a face mask in situations where people cannot physically distance." Julian Tang, a clinical virologist at the University of Leicester in England, said, "The findings support what epidemiologists have been observing on the ground," adding that face masks are very effective, as well as social distancing. "Improved ventilation will also help, particularly if this is close to the source." Dr. Stephen Griffin, associate professor of virology at the University of Leeds, emphasized the importance of ventilation, saying, "Aerosols will fill up indoor spaces rapidly in the absence of proper ventilation. So, assuming the infected individual remains within the room, the levels of virus will be replenished." The same effects were seen across all three SARS-CoV-2 variants the team has tested so far, including the Alpha variant. They hope to start experiments with the Omicron variant in the coming weeks. The pandemic has been awash with slogans, but in recent weeks, two have been repeated with increasing frequency. Variants will evolve to be milder, and COVID will become endemic. Yet experts warn that neither of these things can be taken for granted. Those stating that viruses become less deadly over time often cite influenza. Both of the flu viruses responsible for the 1918 Spanish flu and the 2009 swine flu pandemics eventually evolved to become less dangerous. However, the 1918 virus is thought to have become more deadly before it became milder. And other viruses, such as Ebola, have become more dangerous over time. Professor David Robertson, head of the Viral Genomics and Bioinformatics at the University of Glasgow Centre for Virus Research, said, It's a fallacy that viruses or pathogens become milder if the virus can continue to be transmitted and cause lots of disease. It certainly will. Viruses aim to create as many copies of themselves and spread as widely as possible, although it is not always in their best interest to kill their hosts. So long as they are transmitted before this happens, it doesn't matter. SARS-CoV-2 doesn't kill people during the period when it is most infectious. People tend to die 2 or 3 weeks after becoming ill. Provided it does not evolve to make people so ill that they do not or cannot mix with other people while they're infectious, the virus doesn't care if there are some casualties along the way. Neither is it clear that the SARS-CoV-2 is becoming progressively milder. Omicron variant appears to be less severe and the Alpha or Delta variants, but both of these variants cause more severe illness than the original Wuhan strain. Importantly, viral evolution is not a one-way street. Omicron did not evolve from Delta, and Delta didn't evolve from Alpha. It is more random and unpredictable than that. Robertson says these variants of concern are not going one from the other, and so if the pattern continues and another variant pops out in 6 months' time, it will be worse, adding, it's time not to assume that there's some inevitability for Omicron to be the end of the SARS-CoV-2 evolution. There is a possibility that Omicron is so transmissible that it has hit a ceiling, whereby future variants will struggle to outcompete it. But just a few months ago, people were saying the same thing about the Delta variant. Also, Omicron is likely to keep evolving. Robertson says, what might play out is that as Omicron infects so many people, it's harder for the first Omicron variant to continue to be as successful, and so that creates a space for a virus that's better at evading the immune response. What about the idea that SARS-CoV-2 could become endemic? Politicians tend to use this as a proxy for getting on with our lives and forgetting that COVID-19 exists. What endemic actually means is a disease that's consistently present, but where rates of infection are predictable and not spiraling out of control. Stephen Griffin, Associate Professor of Virology at the University of Leeds, says, smallpox was endemic, polio is endemic, Lassa fever is endemic, and malaria is endemic, adding, measles and mumps are endemic, but dependent on vaccination. Endemic does not mean that something loses its teeth at all.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Almighty Allah, you are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to the Lost Savior. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, I hope you're doing fine, you're doing great, wherever you are. And in case anyone from any part of the world is not feeling well, on this holy land, we pray for your health and your prosperity, your success, inshallah. Dear listeners, in this show, we had been talking about the false claimants of Mahdiyyat who claim to be Mahdi or who claim to be attached to Mahdi, one or the other way. And on that note, we had been talking to
an Islamic scholar, Dr. Murtaza Karimi, and we had this pleasure again to invite him yet again on the show. Assalamu alaikum, Doctor.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome to the show. Thank you so much for accepting the invitation.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Karimi, in the last episode, we discussed about the tricks that these claimants use. And one of the tricks that was being used was miracle. And people so easily believe in it because that's some extraordinary thing you're doing that the normal people cannot do. Now you talk about the person that we have currently in Basra. What kind of miracles does he use? Or like, I would want you to expand or analyze these miracles.
This false claimant from Basra, he says that I have a couple of miracles. One of them is that he says that I know where the grave of Fatima al-Zahra, salamullah alayha, is. She is buried next to her son, Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, in the cemetery of Baqi. And the other ones are quoted by his followers. They say that, for example, a person suffering from cancer was healed and cured because of the fact that he believed in this person, in this false claimant. And in other report and a story, we are told that he put his hand or rubbed his hand on the eyes of a couple of people, and then they were able to see the angel.
Were not able to see.
Yeah. So,
or like who were, he did not, you mean to say he rubbed his hand on the eyes of the people who were blind, or like he rubbed his hand on the eyes of people to give them extraordinary capability to see angels?
Yeah, these are reported by his followers.
All
now,
right.
Analyzing these miracles, we said that miracle is something that, first of all, cannot be done by other people. And second of all, the other important feature of miracle that it should be performed in front of other people.
Right.
So imagine Jesus alayhi salam comes to people and tell them that I'm the prophet. Why? Because 10 days ago I cured a person in my house and none of you were present. So no one would believe in him. Miracles should be performed in front of the people so that people come to believe in him. Moses alayhi salam performed his miracles in front of the people and before Pharaoh, for example. So this is the point. Now, when it comes to the miracles attributed to this person, we see that just they are reported in the books published by the same people. So it's not the way to prove that this is a kind of miracle. If you are telling the truth, you need to, I mean, invite all the people, including the people, I mean, at least a number of the people, including those who do not believe in you, and then perform the miracle and claim that I'm Imam or related
I'm
to Imam Mahdi.
Or like I have this capability of
that's
doing
the
miracles.
Point. So any person just can claim that yesterday I did a lot of miracles in my house and no one was present except my children, for example, but believe in me. I mean, it's ridiculous to have such
and
a
that
claim.
That way everyone does miracles.
Yeah, does miracles, yeah. So this is the first point about those miracles like, I mean, healing the people and so on and so forth, or the claim that those people were able to see the angels and so on and so forth. This should be done in front of the people, and none of them has been, I mean, done based on this condition. They are just reported stories of those who
blindly are following him.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Dr. Karimi, we'll be talking to you about these tricks. Here we need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
the next point is that the miracle of a prophet or imam should not go against the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam. When it comes to the grave of Lady Fatima Zahra Salamun Alayha, first of all, it is not a miracle. Technically, miracle is an act that you do and other people cannot do the same. You just claim that her grave is in Baqi. I may claim that no, her grave is next to her father or in her house. Anyone can make the same claim. I mean, what is your argument to prove that? So exactly. Again, technically speaking, it's not, I mean, a miracle to begin with. And not only that, when we refer to the narrations of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, we see that, first of all, there are different viewpoints regarding the place where Fatimah Zahra Salamullah Alayha was buried. And Baqi is one of the weakest ones based on the narrations in Shia sources.
All right.
And, I mean, most of the narrations, they refer to her house and maybe next to the, in Masjid al-Nabi and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So to believe that she is buried in Baqi is going against many narrations that we have in Shia sources. And the next point is that there was a philosophy behind hiding the grave of Fatimah Zahra Salamun Alayha by Imam Hadi.
She herself wanted to get buried at night. She did not want like anyone to know about it. Like when she was alive, she tells all that to Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Mm-hmm.
However, like how can we as the followers of her tell today that her grave is there when she herself does not want people mm-hmm. to know about it?
So the request of Fatimah Zahra Salamun Alayha was based on a wisdom. What was done by Imam Ali alayhi salam was based on a wisdom. And now if you want to reveal that place, it means that you're going against that wisdom. And according to the narrations, it is the, I mean, job of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam who will tell the people about
where is the grave of the Zahra.
So having said that, we come to this conclusion that unfortunately some of these false claimants, they just claim to have performed miracles, but when we analyze their actions, we see that none of them has those conditions which are mentioned in the books of theology for a mu'jiza or a miracle.
As you talk about these tricks, there's one more interesting thing. That is a dream that you mentioned about in the earlier episode. However, I would want you to expand that topic. What is this dream kind of thing? How is this used as a trick?
Yes, we have had a couple of sessions talking about dream in details, so I don't want to repeat all those discussions. Just quickly, to refer to dream as one of the tricks of the false claimants. Unfortunately, this is one of the most common tricks of different false claimants. We can see in the history of Islam, people like Abdullah bin Hashim, who passed away in 658, Fadlullah Hurufi, 796 after Hijra. He founded a sect called Hurufiya, and Muhammad ibn Abdullah Nurbash, he passed away in 869, and he was the founder of Nur Bakhshiya sect.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them, they tried to prove their viewpoints based on dreams. They told the people that in a dream you will be told that I'm telling you the truth. In our time, we have a person called Mahdi Sudani, who passed away in 1302 after Hijra. Mirza Ahmed Qadiani, he passed away in 08 A.D., Juhayman al-Utaybi, and last but not the least, of course, this false claimant from Basra that we have talked about him a lot. All of them, they have resorted to a dream to prove that they are telling the truth. Not only that, in our time, again, we have another false claimant. I don't want to mention his name. But he says that dream is one of the pillars of Islam.
All right.
And he says that if the whole religion has two pillars, one of them is for sure the dream.
Dream.
You need to believe in this. You need to accept this from me. Otherwise, you are a disbeliever. I repeat that. If the religion of Islam has two pillars, one of them is dream.
Dream. And if you do not believe in one of these pillars, like dream, you are a disbeliever.
Yeah. Again, it's very unfortunate to see that for any of these false claimants, we have a couple of, a few people who are accepting their viewpoints. Because of those sessions, I'm not going to repeat what all those points that I mentioned. I just refer to one narration in this regard.
Al-ajal mundo,
Imam Sadiq alayhi salam asks one of his companions about what people, especially the enemies of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, do in their prayers regarding, for example, ruku, bowing down, and prostration, sujood. The companion says that I explained the Imam the way that they are saying their prayers, and the reason is that they claim that Ubay ibn Ka'b, he saw a dream and it was the way that prayer was performed in his dream. Now, the answer of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, I think, is the criterion for our discussion on dream. Imam alayhi salam says that إِنَّ دِينَ اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ أَعَزُّ مِنْ أَن يُرَى فِي النَّوْمِ. The religion of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is more honored than to be seen in a dream. Meaning that you should not take your religion from dream. Religion needs to be based on, rational arguments, based on Quran, based on the narrations. When we refer to the Shia scholars, we see that, for example, Sheikh al-Mufid, he says that we do not prove even any of the Islamic laws based on the dreams. Mm-hmm. When it comes to fiqh or jurisprudence, you cannot find any Shia jurist to say that this is my verdict because I saw a dream and I saw, for example, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and he told me that this is the Islamic law for prayer, fasting. No.
The jurisprudence use Quran, Sunnah, and...
And intellect.
In fact, the intellect.
Yeah.
As the sources to take out or draw some of the rulings.
Mm-hmm. So when this is the case for jurisprudence, for sure, for beliefs, we cannot resort to a dream.
And in case of belief, it's interesting that in jurisprudence, you can imitate. But in belief, you cannot imitate. You can use reason and logic. You have to use reason and logic to analyze things, to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I cannot believe in Allah if someone else is believing in Allah as well. I have to use logic, intellect, and I have to analyze things. I have to use my wisdom to reach that point. Yes, Allah does exist.
Mm-hmm.
I have to analyze nature and, you know, see Allah in each and everything. Not just believe in Allah, just like, for example, my parents believe in Allah. But in jurisprudence, we have imitation, not in belief. And this is a part of belief we are talking about.
That's the point. So, our dear listeners, if you find any claimant who says that if you want to know that I'm with the truth, you may recite the following prayer, supplication, or fast for a couple of days, and then you will be told in a dream that I'm with the truth, again, make sure that he's a liar, because this is not rooted in our religion. Our Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, they have instructed us to take the religion from the Quran, from the Ahlul Bayt, from the Prophet and our intellect, and not from a dream.
Of course. However, Doctor, it was really very nice to be with you on the show. You really added to our knowledge. Thank you so much. And I think the people who are really trapped, troubled enough, those are the people who become victims of these claimants. Inshallah, may Allah help them. Dr. Karimi, as he suggested, all the people to use intellect, Quran and Sunnah, and obviously the Imams, in order to believe in these things or not. Thank you so much for listening to IRIB English Radio. This was The Last Savior. For now, this is Zainab with our whole team saying goodbye.
Where is the rising sun? This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies.
shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.